Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English death.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and...
Jake.
McClure. I got through that. I thought that was pretty impressive.
We were able to say our names once more. We did it. Flawlessly able to say our own names.
Well, I don't know if it was flawless, but we got...
Okay, flawed ability to say our own names.
Yeah, yeah.
Sort of. Sometimes... And then other times not so well.
Well, it's important to know that the telephone number to call in here if you want to join with us today, if wherever you are, is October 27th, which means we're closing in on the end of October of 2018, is 254-773-1400 here on KTEM. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and we talk about things that have to do with economics and investing and so on. We talked about the fact that... 3.5% growth in the GDP, but there are certain warning signs coming up. That's 17% lower than last quarter, and there's warning signs in the system that says the growth, we're not plunging into recession or anything, but the future growth of the GDP in the next quarter and in the quarters to come looks strongly like it's going to be less, and it's going to coast back down towards the 1 or 2% range over the next couple of years. And that's just one of those things we need to be aware of and recognize. Another question. I haven't heard anybody call in about it.
I was going to say something, too. Go ahead. Go ahead.
We generated this burst in GDP and this overheating economy and everything else that's going with it by borrowing a truly phenomenal amount of money. We're now in fiscal year 2019 for the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
And even the administration is predicting at this point...
$1 trillion deficit.
A $1 trillion deficit when we don't have a recession going. What happened to all of the conservatives who said deficit spending like this was bad?
Right. Well, we're sitting right here. We're still talking about it.
Well, you and I are talking about it. But
yeah, and I consider myself a fiscal conservative. This is not fiscal conservatism. If you have a $1 trillion deficit and you're okay with it... Now, let me take a step back for a moment, because we've increased spending for the military. And this is something you and I have talked about needing to do since sequestration happened. We've got two wars that are still active, and we've got lots of little hot spots that we are active in. We've got constant fleet activities going on around the globe. That means things break, and we've got to fix them. And we're spending more because we have the hot spots, but that's kind of irrelevant when you look at the budget. We need to make sure our equipment's not broken. So we needed to do this, and it's more of a symptom of 8 years of really not pushing for military spending to fix back what we had. But when we increase spending across the board, in order to increase the military spending, we had to agree to increase spending on lots of other stuff. So we've got this year, we've got record income to the government, not at the corporate level, at the individual level. We've got a record amount of tax revenue coming into the federal government. At the corporate level, it's dropped, because we dropped taxes drastically at the corporate level. But we have a record amount of individual income taxes coming in. We have a booming economy, and we're running a deficit of $1 trillion. What happens when the economy is not booming? Because that happens. Because then tax revenue drops. If we keep on spending like this, we're going to be in trouble. Well, we may be in trouble already.
Well... You know, the point is, if you look and say, okay, where are we going to stop spending, and you listen to the rhetoric about it at least, it boils down to the fact, well, let's stop giving out welfare, let's stop foreign aid, and what you wind up with is cutting maybe 2% off spending if you hit every one of those items hard. The difficulty is, frankly, we in the United States want the government to provide a lot of services. We want it to provide a lot of support. We want FDIC insurance. We want a big defense. We want a defense capable of defending the entire world.
Mm-hmm.
We want the FBI to do their job correctly. We want the Weather Service to do their job correctly.
But we don't want to pay the taxes necessary to pay for all of that.
And that's the really, and I know this is, if I was running for office, this would be a suicide.
Right, absolutely. Can't get elected by saying raise taxes. Try it. It's not going
to
happen.
It really boils down to the fact that we need to be willing to pay for what we want the government to do. And if you say, well, they should cut waste and fraud. Well, they've cut waste and fraud a lot. The bottom line to it is that the only way we could bring the budget into even vaguely close to balance is massive cuts in Social Security, defense. What was the other one? Social Security, defense.
Medicare.
And Medicare.
Yeah, Medicare is bigger than Social Security. And the prescription drug benefit plan is huge.
And
it's unfunded.
And our solution, based on the tax and spending bill that we got at the beginning of the year, the solution is, okay, let's cut taxes.
And borrow the money.
And borrow the money and put ourselves in the position where the interest debt within a couple of years will be bigger than Medicare, which is bigger than defense.
Right. In 2024, well, 2023, we're going to spend more on interest on the debt than we do on defense. That's a problem. It's not a problem yet. I mean, we still have 2023. That sounds like way in the future. It's not. That's 5 years away.
And there's a fundamental rule of economics that's largely being ignored at the political level, and that is the more borrowing there is, the higher interest rates go.
Yeah.
In other words,
it's supply and demand.
It's strictly a supply and demand issue. If you want to borrow a lot of money, you're going to do like the typical Visa card holder. By the way, Visa reported its, and this sounds like I'm segueing off, but I'm not.
It's not.
This is how
same
it works.
Subject.
Visa reported they had roughly a 12% increase in business, but a 54% increase in
revenue.
Profits in,
yeah.
for the full year, fiscal year 2018. How did they do that? Because more people are borrowing more money at higher interest rates.
Yeah.
So that 12% of additional business they're doing, the 12% of additional lending, is at some ridiculous high interest rates. I've got a deal that I did where I bought something and they 1 year no interest on a card.
And they kick it in at 28.8% at the end of it?
29%. If I 29%
interest. You don't have it paid off?
If I don't pay it off in 1 year or if I miss a payment, then they kick in 29% interest on the entire thing from the beginning.
Yeah.
And that's where Visa is making their big money. And frankly, that's the problem that we're running into at the federal level. We're borrowing this money.
And the interest rates are going up.
And it's because one of the reasons interest rates are going up is because we're borrowing a lot of money.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to hear somebody argue the other side of this.
Well, I don't think anybody out there is going to. Let's take a step. We have both enjoyed the extra money from the tax cut. I have. I basically put the down payment on a house based on the tax cut. I have, we're living very well, and I'm saving money because I don't think that the government's going to be able to keep taxes as low as they are for as long as they think they will because of the deficits. So we have both benefited from the tax cut, greatly benefited. Lots of money has come back to us that we would have given to the government. And from that, that made me happy. I'm very happy to receive that. So there's a dichotomy. You can do more with the money that you would be giving to the government. You could buy things with it. You can invest. There's a lot of things you could be doing. The government still needs money to pay for the things it's doing. And we've made a decision as a people to borrow that money rather than to pay for it now. And that's a simple statement. The president's upset with the Federal Reserve for raising interest rates, short-term interest rates. At the same time, the president's decisions have left the Federal Reserve with no recourse. They must raise interest rates. It's their job at this point to raise interest rates. Their rule book is pretty clear. If they see inflation, they've got to start raising interest rates. Well, we're seeing inflation. And the president can be upset at the Fed or can take a step back and say, how do we sustain the growth that we have? And you don't sustain growth by giving it steroids. You sustain growth by feeding it properly. by making sure that it is sustainable. This is, you know, to go to a farm analogy. If you grow more on a given plot of land than you should, you can deplete the land. That's capacity. There's a lot of things that you can add back to the soil, but that's an expensive thing. We're not adding back to the soil right now. We're not spending money on logistics. We are not increasing our flow on the highways. We're not building bridges. We're not building new roads. So all of that means that we're not replenishing the soil, which is a long-term problem. It feels good right now because we're selling a lot of crops. And please believe me, I'm happy that we're selling a lot of crops right now. This is good. We have a booming economy, and it's not about to stop at the moment. Now is the time to plan for when it stops. Just like in the recession, we were planning for the boom times. In the boom times, plan for the recession. It's not like they stop happening, and that's something that I have to remind people. Why are you so pessimistic all the time? These are the same people that called us optimists all the time when we were down in the depths in the recession. The American economy is strong. We love America. We love the economy of America. In fact, I don't know almost, I can't name someone else that's as impassioned as we are about the American economy, about how we fit in the world. We're productive. We are innovative. If you take 9 out of 10 tech companies, they're going to be American. If you take them from all over the world, they're going to be American because we lead the world in so many things. But that's because we have been farsighted. Let's not get short-sighted and rest on our hubris. Let's not get our laurels off our head and put them on our butt. And that's why that resting on the laurels comes from, by the way, the Roman Empire. When someone was a hero, they would come back and be given a laurel crown. And in a debate, quite often, to end the debate, if one side had a laurel crown from the past and the other side did not, they would just rest their hand lightly on the laurel crown and say, "What have you done?" Well, let's not completely rest on our laurels. We've got them. We've got tons of them. We're amazing. But we got to keep planning for the future.
And we have a caller on 773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Person Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, there was a lot of talk about the Chinese as part of the trade contracts or deals ripping off American technology. I don't know how true is that? And if this trade deal gets settled, is that going to clean up the potential holes in that? I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Good question. How true is it?
It's very true.
Very true.
In other words, in order to do business in China, they often required that companies give their trade secrets to their Chinese partners, which in the Chinese partners then would effectively use those trade secrets against them later on.
Not just those Chinese partners, but the entire Chinese economy. Because
right.
One thing that is not made clear enough is that every corporation in China has on the corporation's payroll a whole department that is really a government department. They are the party. And their job is to report those secrets to the to other companies that are also party companies to use,
you know,
if they need to.
You ask the question, is this new trade deal going to clean it? There is no new trade deal.
We don't know what a trade deal is. There's nothing in writing.
Personally, my position, and I'm not the only one that has it, other economists have it that way too, and it is that we could have addressed that issue by itself and gone in there and said, okay, we got to stop this. Or you're going to get punished this way. Instead of doing that, we went in and said, you'll either reduce the trade deficit by exporting less stuff to the United States, or we're going to impose tariffs on you.
Well, the tariffs caused their imports to our country to go up, not down.
Yeah, in other words, the tariffs had a reverse effect, and they were a shotgun effect. And a lot of times in negotiation, if you get a narrow target that you say, this is the target we're going to shoot at and we're going to hit it and we're going to focus everything on this target, you can accomplish something. On the other hand, if you go up against a country whose economy is largely based in exports and say, we want you to shut down your economy. It's the equivalent. I'm going to use a good parallel here. It's equivalent to the Kyoto Accords.
I was going to use something similar, yeah, even more specific, and one that should grab a lot of people by the eardrums right away, carbon credits.
Yeah, well, the Kyoto Accords basically said the United States, we're producing too much carbon in the world, we're causing global warming.
So shut it all off.
So turn your economy down and put people out of work. And we said,
not no, but hell no.
And the Chinese, we've gone to the Chinese with basically the same thing. You know, there's a trade imbalance. And what we want you to do is put a lot of people out of work and slow your economy down and cause a recession. And they are saying not no, but hell no.
Right. And the parallels are so stark. The whole concept of a carbon credit, which most, even saying the word carbon credit around a conservative generally makes them turn red in the face and have bulging veins. Tariffs are that. A tariff is a carbon credit. It is an artificial tax on business based on something that's not business oriented. So if we're talking about greenhouse gas emissions or imports or exports, that's a problem. When we're the trade that we have with China. First, let me say some of the clear instances where China is absolutely in the wrong. Not only do they get our secrets in a sort of legal but definitely arm-twisting manner. If you're building a plant in China, you've got to share your secrets or you can't build the plant there. They also near shamelessly just copy our stuff, even the stuff that we haven't set up a plant in China to do. There's just looking at the Apple stuff, the number of knockoff Apple phones in China is, there are more counterfeit Apple phones in China than there are real Apple phones in the United States. That says something. They've got an intellectual property problem. That's a long-term problem for China. It's a short-term problem for us in that we don't get the profits that we want because people are buying knockoffs. Good thing about the knockoffs on the Apple phones, the iPhones, is that the knockoff iPhones don't work very well in China. So that's and people say, is it a knockoff or is it real? The real ones work, and they know it. So the short-term problem is that we won't get all the sales that we want. We will lose our secrets, and they'll be able to compete with us. The long-term problem is China's not going to be able to innovate, and they're going to stagnate or just continue to copy everyone else, and there's a limit to how long they can do that. When we go to them with trade negotiations, and I've looked at the documents that we're talking with the Chinese have no counter. And we have a very vague list of issues that we want to have solved, starting with, you've got to lower your imports to us. That's a no-go. It's a good opening negotiation, but these negotiations have been going on for longer than 8 months now. We haven't gotten past the opening argument. That's a problem. I'm not sure that the president has his mind completely on the China negotiations. I think there are a lot of other things that have the president's mind at the moment. That's costly to the economy. That's a problem. So the long-term issues here, one, we've got to plan ahead. China has to plan ahead. When we're building plans for the future, we've got to have some stability to build those plans on. And that means that government's got to do its job, whether it's Congress, the president, to say, here's what's going on into the future. And this is, I know the Federal Reserve doesn't get a lot of praise. One thing that I'm going to say that is fantastic about the last two decades of the Federal Reserve is that they have been moving steadily, slowly, dragging their feet, but doing it to more transparency, where they're telling us what they're going to do. Because in the age of Volcker and Greenspan, a raise in interest rates or a drop in interest rates was a surprise on the day that it happened. We now know from the Federal Reserve way in advance what's going to happen. They come out, they talk about it, they say everybody on the board is saying that we're going to raise interest rates, and then when it happens, there is not a crazy movement in the market. And you were looking at the looking for a clock, which...
Well, yeah, this clock here says it's 6:20.
Do you see what color Rush Limbaugh's hair is on that clock?
Yeah, and
it's black.
That
Lynn Woolley is... he looks like he's in his mid-30s on that clock.
Yeah, so there's lots of people that...
That clock has stopped, and it stopped decades ago.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
we can't look at that for the time.
Probably should ignore that clock. But we still probably ought to do some commercials.
Yeah, we can do that. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400. We'll be back on the other side.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And
we've got a caller waiting. Hopefully they're still waiting on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hey, I had a question. You mentioned Apple in a reference to knockoff products in China and stuff.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you guys have thoughts on the right to repair acts that have been proposed. And I know that's a conversation going on, especially...
Yeah.
With a lot of Chinese counterfeit products coming in. So I'll jump off, but I was just wondering what kind of thoughts you guys had on that.
All right. Do you want me to cover that?
Sure, go ahead.
All right. That's a fantastic question. The right to repair is one of those areas where our intellectual property laws and our lawsuit laws are wrapped up on this concept of, like, it's our immune system in the United States to prevent illegal copies. If you have a vehicle, so you have a Ford, right? You do have a Chevy. What do you have?
Right, I have a Chevy.
You have a Chevy. Okay, you have a Chevy.
I have a big Chevy pickup.
How would you feel if you were only allowed to have your Chevy pickup worked at the Chevy dealership? No one else was allowed to do it, or you could have a lawsuit against you.
I would be very unhappy about that. Matter of fact, I sort of experienced that at one point.
Yeah. The way many of our electronic gadgets work is based on that concept. If you have a PlayStation of any number from Sony, if you, they have copyrighted and trademarked all of the internal components. Even the act of opening it violates the copyright. So there have been lawsuits out there, and lawsuits is now being settled in courts where the courts have said, hey, you can't do that. But there's no law. Well, the law that is on the book says that Sony's allowed to do that, that Apple's allowed to do that, that the only place you're allowed to have your iPhone worked on is at Apple. If you take that to another place, Apple's probably not going to try to sue you on it. But they're certainly going to void everything that they hold as a responsibility to you. If for instance, you took your car to get its oil changed at another location, and then there was a recall for your airbag, if you showed up at the dealership and they said, we're not going to replace your airbag because you had your oil changed somewhere else, this is the same law. So the right to repair, who owns the gadget when you buy it? According to the law right now, you don't own it. When it comes to many of your electronic gadgets, according to the legal translation in the court, you might own it. So there are laws out there that are being suggested, bills that are being created, the right to repair, meaning that once you bought the equipment, it belongs to you. You're allowed to take it apart. You're allowed to change the operating system. There was a big lawsuit, and this is the one. There were a whole series of big lawsuits that got settled, but one actually went to court where Sony sued, and I'm going to put quotes around this, hackers. It wasn't really hackers. They replaced the operating system on the PlayStations with different operating systems. They wanted to try Linux on it. They wanted to try Windows on it. And they got sued for listing how to do that on an online forum. That was a breach of copyright, according to Sony. So a whole series of people settled out of court because Sony has a massive army of attorneys. It finally went to court, and the lawsuit was determined against Sony that they were allowed to do it. But that's not what the law says. So the right to repair intellectual property is what we have a problem with at China. They have intellectual property laws that are not strong enough or don't exist at all.
Well, actually, I did some research on this. And it seems to me like that China has the laws on the book. They just have the... I don't know. Maybe the inability isn't the term, but the fundamental... I think the government makes an effort, has been making an effort, they've been making an increasing effort to enforce copyright laws. Like mm-hmm. they routinely arrest people and put them in prison for illegal manufacture of copyrighted goods. Now, are they putting their whole heart into it? There's no way we can know. But the problem
there is... There is a way we can know. They're not, because there's massive manufacturers of fake iPhones right next to the iPhone plant.
Sure. The point is that... One of the things is there's a fundamental cultural issue there. It's kind of the Wild West in China in many ways.
Yeah. It's a new system.
And very frankly, in the 19th century in the United States routinely ignored copyrights in Europe.
Yeah, because we were Wild West, literally Wild West.
And we were the big developing country that was going to take over the world in the next century.
And we did.
And now that we're on top, we suddenly get very, very, very sensitive about this. Do I think that it's appropriate that the Chinese try to copy things? No, but do you remember there was a time when the Japanese did the same thing?
Right.
And hopefully the Chinese will get over it. On the other hand, while I think, again, I said this last hour, putting a lot of pressure on the Chinese to stop this illegal, very clearly illegal behavior is one thing. Telling them to shut down their export machine that powers their economy is another thing. Because you're not going to, very frankly, we're not going to win that. And the reason we won it in Korea. Korea negotiated a new deal where they said we'll put caps on our exports.
Right. But that's because we have NAFTA, defense agreements with them. They need us for defense at the moment.
And they're a relatively small economy compared to the United States.
Right.
And they don't have to worry about, you know, I don't. We heard George W. Bush speak one time, and he, I don't remember who the prime minister of China was at the time, but the prime minister of China asked him, he said, what is the thing you most fear? And he feared a dirty bomb going off in New York City.
Right.
And so President Bush then asked the premier of China, what do you fear the most? And he said, not having work for 650 million people who move from job to job. 650 million workers.
That's double the population of the United States.
And these are people who are moving from job to job.
This isn't their main population. This is the job-to-job people.
So when you got a country that is terrified of putting a lot of people out of work, and willing to do almost anything to avoid that from happening because they think it will probably be a revolution if they do, and you tell them, put a lot of people out of work and stop exporting so much stuff.
They're not going to do it.
They, you know, over a long period of time, and they have, by the way, committed to a long period, but to tell them to stop doing it instantly, like I said, it's like somebody telling us to slow our economy down so we stop polluting so much.
Yeah. If you don't want to make a deal with China, that's understandable. But to make the deal itself be the deal breaker, then you get a political boost by saying, I'm trying to make them do this, but your end result is going to be dangerous. Dangerous in a lot of different meanings. So this concept of how do we get China to enforce intellectual property laws? And if you look at where they were even 10 years ago, as far as intellectual property enforcement versus today, you're going to find that they are much better at it now than they were then. They've built whole systems to do it. They still have a massive problem in that area, and some of it is structural. Some of it is part of the government, where their government is saying, this is totally legal. Give us your secrets or you can't build your plant here.
Well, it really is... We say that's an illegitimate negotiating term, but basically, if you don't want to build your plant and manufacture things in China, you don't have to give them your secrets.
Right, and see, the reality is that Tesla didn't give them their secrets to put a plant in China. They said, no, we won't do it that way, and China really wanted them there anyway. So if you've got something that they want, they'll take that as well. And that's, you know, they wanted Tesla to be there. So there are negotiations that have to happen, but we have to set the rules for the negotiating table in a trade law. We don't have that with China. And on Thursday, the Trump administration said that they will not go back to the table with the Chinese negotiators until the Chinese present a plan. Well, the Trump administration hasn't presented a plan either. So what that means is that we are set to have the tariffs on $200 billion worth of stuff go from 10% to 25% on January 1st.
And that, frankly, is one of the reasons we saw a market downturn
yeah.
this last week, the last several weeks, is I think the manufacturers and merchants across the country and investors are seeing that, no, this is not a negotiating ploy. We really are likely to have a 25% tariff on everything out of China. And until the courts, if the courts were to overturn it, that is going to be extremely expensive, because if you look around your house and you go and look at everything that has something in it that's made in China, you realize that that is a that means that the prices and everything that you have are going to jump up. You're going to buy less of them, which means that the earnings are going to go down in the United States and inflation's going to go up. I mean, that's just
right.
That's all that those tariffs will do. Will they slow down
this
purchases in China? Not particularly.
We may be getting lost in the woods here. Let's come out to the big picture. What is a tariff and who pays it?
It's a tax.
It's a tax on the consumer. It's a consumer tax, not a manufacturer tax. And that's something that people lose, because tariff has been out of the textbooks for a long time. It's been out of the public attention for a long time. It is a tax on you. It is a tax on me. Tariff is a tax on the consumer, not the manufacturer. And you can look at it any way you want to look at it. It's a sales tax. It's a sales tax that occurs before the time of sale.
It's basically a value-added tax.
Right, without a value-added. It's just, unless you say crossing the border adds value. Being in the United States adds value, which it might.
And here's the interesting thing. You think, okay, well, it only applies to things you import. No.
It applies to things that use imported parts.
But it also applies to things that are made here.
Yeah.
If you put we've seen this, the price of aluminum jump 40%. When we put a 10% tariff on it.
And steel is up 60% when we put a 25% tariff on it.
The manufacturers in the United States boosted their price up to that same level to make it in the United States, which means that the people who buy cars and everything else, and we haven't seen this hit yet, by the way, and it is an important factor that's already beginning to emerge, and this is why we are so against the tariffs. Automobile sales are dropping, which happens in an economic cycle at about this point when the economy starts to peak and starts to level off, that is inevitably followed by a recession. Automobile sales and home sales drop first, and we've seen both of those occur. Now, the point is, the tariffs raise the cost of the steel that goes into the automobiles, and that's hitting just as sales of automobiles are starting to drop. Just as sales of houses are starting to drop because of the lumber tariffs.
And labor shortages.
And labor shortages and generally.
And steel.
And a whole series of other things. It's getting compounded by the application of tariffs at the same time. It's when all these things, what are called counter-cyclical, they're reinforcing cyclical issues, come together, that's what causes a recession, which is one of the reasons we say probable recession in 2020. Without the tariffs, now this is an interesting concept, without the tariffs and without the tax cuts, there was no prediction of a recession in 2020 for many economists. With the tariffs and the tax cut, there is a nearly unanimous agreement among economists that sometime around 2020 we will have a significant recession.
Yeah,
that should tell you a world about economics and about how it works. You can't. There's no such thing as a free lunch. There's no way to do something that looks good politically or looks good for you as a company even, that doesn't have a price with it. And the price is that you're going to see prices starting to go up. They're already starting to go up, but if you actually track things, you're going to see prices of things you buy over the next year rise.
Yeah, you're starting to see it already. It's already happening. Electronic prices, which are something that we had fairly reliably seen prices drop as we had better manufacturing techniques and so on, those are the prices that are going up right now. And you can here's a perfect example. Look at your phone. How much does your phone cost? It's been a pretty normal, flat amount for a decade, where phones didn't cost a lot more than about $600. The first iPhone came out, it was about $600. The first Android came out, it was about $600. In the last year, we're up to $1,000 a phone as the norm. That is the new phone price. Well, where did that come from? It's the same built-in extra costs. You could say that, well, they've added a lot of extra technology, but if you look back throughout the progression from the first iPhone to the last iPhone, from the first Android to the last Android, what you'll see is that every generation of Androids has had a lot of technical increases, and you can say the technical increases with the big price associated with them that's just happened aren't even as big as some of the technical increases that happened in the midpoint that didn't add even a dollar to the price.
So, if I can change the subject just a little bit.
Yes, please. We may have kicked this horse enough.
In the short term, I'm optimistic. Well, we got to do some more commercials.
We got some more commercials, too. So, in the short term, we're optimistic.
In the short term, I'm optimistic. In other words, the fact that we are having a correction right now may be a big positive. Now, I'm not going to...
I think it is a big positive.
I can't tell the future, and I'm not claiming to tell the future. But my subconscious mind talks to me a lot about what I could probably expect based on what I've experienced in roughly 35 years in the investment business. And my sense is we will get a bounce back in the market and a resumption of the bull market probably following the elections.
I agree. I think after the midterm elections, no matter what happens, blue wave, red wave, no wave, placid waters, ripples, I think we'll see people get their head out of politics and back into the economy. And we have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, yeah. You are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach.
Yeah, quick question, then I'll get off and listen. I know y'all don't have a lot of time. Put your forward and rear-looking hats on. Where would the economy be today had Hillary Clinton won versus where we're at today? And where would the economy be in 2 years had Hillary Clinton won instead of Trump? And which one would you prefer? Thanks.
All right.
Boy, talking about a loaded question.
Yeah, what I can say from what we were saying in our analysis during the election year is that 2017 was set to be a good year no matter who won. And if you look at the economic policies that were put into place in 2017 that actually took place in 2017, there weren't any. There were no major changes to the economy based on who was in office in 2017. We got the tax cut at the end of the year, and that caused the market to go up. We would not have gotten the tax cut had Hillary Clinton been in office. So last quarter, if we look at all other things, if we were to remove the extra money from the tax cut, we may have seen a relatively low GDP number for the last two quarters. It probably would not have been 4.2 and then 3.5.
No,
we would have been probably in the twos.
Well, I don't know, because you look back to 20... During the Obama administration, you look back to several occasions we had this kind of short-term growth.
Right, but we can attribute this growth that we've seen from government, from money coming back into the economy or government spending, a big chunk of it.
We would have still had the bull market.
Yeah.
We wouldn't probably have an overheating economy at this point had Hillary Clinton been elected. We would still be growing. We'd still be in expansion mode.
Which we still are, in either way.
In other words, things would have gotten better. They would have gotten better slowly. We've said this over and over again. Who is elected president doesn't really make that much difference.
In this case, it does.
Well, I mean, it, in the economy. In the short term, it may make a difference because we wouldn't have gotten the tax cuts.
The tariffs are the big thing this year.
But we wouldn't have the tariffs. So there's one negative that would be out of it, and right. there's a positive that would be out of it.
The tariff is a tax. So we had a tax increase and a tax cut. Probably neither of those would have happened.
Which would I have preferred? That was the last question.
Which would you have preferred?
I have no idea.
No idea. Uh-huh. It's really hard to go back in time and figure out what would have happened.
I basically look at it like this. Whoever gets elected president got elected under the Constitution. I took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution, so whoever's president is president. I don't refer to President Trump as Trump. I refer to him as President Trump. I give him all the respect due to the office of president and will as long as he is president of the United States. Whether I agree or disagree, I happen to think some of the things he's doing are brilliant and some of the things he's doing are incredibly stupid. But that's just my personal opinion. Has little to do with the economy.
A professional opinion as well.
My preference is very simple. We adhere to the Constitution. We elect presidents in an orderly fashion. And if we don't like the president we have, 4 years later, we have the opportunity to replace that president, whoever he or she may be.
And I'm going to throw in, just because I guess I like pain, I'm going to throw in that what I said before the election still stands, in my opinion. I believe that the Clinton family was corrupt and is still corrupt in many ways. That doesn't mean that they're horrible, nasty people, but I think that they've just built their lives around being able to take advantage of the system. And I think that the Trump family is corrupt because they've been able to build their resources over taking advantage of the system. So I felt like in that election that there were no good options. And when I look at the presidency today, he is my president. President Trump is my president,
and
he's got my support.
Right.
But I feel like it's my duty and my obligation to say when I have studied something thoroughly that this is a bad decision, or when I've studied something thoroughly, it's a good decision. And I'm standing by some things that I said, based on the invasion of Iraq during George W. Bush. We were absolutely in support of that we wanted them to do nation building at the end of it, and we did it kind of on the low budget. That's not good. That doesn't work historically. The Marshall Plan was a big budget thing, and by going low budget, we are still funding a huge portion of the Iraqi government, where with the Germans, a decade later, they were on their own and doing quite well. Now, it's a different culture, different society, but I think we tried to do it halfway. And when it comes to what would have happened had Hillary Clinton come in, I think we would have just as many political scandals. I think that the Republicans would be chasing Hillary Clinton the same way that the Democrats are chasing Donald Trump, that they would find anything that they could possibly find to make a scandal out of, because they are polarizing figures, either one of them.
So I guess who would I prefer for president? D, none of the above.
Yeah. And what I am
actually
satisfied
actually
with,
I'd like Ronald Reagan back as president.
Right. I am satisfied with the president that we have. I think that there are a lot of actions that he's taken that were not the intention of the law around what he did. But that gives us the ability in the future to say, do we want all future presidents to be able to do that? And another example of this is FDR. Incredibly popular president. He pulled us out of the Depression and took us most of the way through World War II. He was also elected for a fourth term in office. He had the potential and was actually president for life. He was president for three full terms and one partial term, and afterwards we said, hey, maybe we shouldn't do that again. Not because we don't like FDR, because even then he was still incredibly popular, but because maybe nobody should be allowed to have that much power concentrated in one person. And in Texas, we don't allow even the governor to do much of anything. I like Texas's government. All right.
We've got commercials.
We've got to play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. The phone number in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back.
And We're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure on this October 27th, year of our Lord, 2018. And if you'd like to give us a call in here, 254-773-1400 is the number, but you better call pretty quick because we only got about 4.5 minutes left in this second hour today. And we've been talking about the stock market's down in correction territory somewhere, and it's likely, we believe, it's likely to rebound later in the year. We've been talking about the 3.5% GDP, which is really going like gangbusters, and that in and of itself is a bit of a problem. As we coast down towards the end, be prepared for lower GDP numbers in the fourth quarter, and matter of fact, the Federal Reserve, the Wall Street Journal, and economists in general are saying that next year you'll see the GDP numbers drop into the twos. 2.5% is what they're saying early next year, dropping to 1.8% at some point. So just be prepared for that and recognize that the markets are not going to be too happy with it. So we're going to see some volatility in the markets. But there's a fundamental issue here. The forward price-to-earnings ratio, which is fairly accurate at this point and has been since the 2000 debacle,
That's the Enron Arthur Andersen problem where we couldn't tell really what earnings were. We're pretty good on it now.
Like this quarter so far, 57% of the companies reporting have actually beat their earnings estimates. So when we look at a year out at the earnings estimates, we can say they are generally going to be a little bit on the conservative side. And if we use a year from now's earnings estimates based on analysts and companies' forward projected earnings, and you add it all together, we have about a 15 or 16 price to earnings ratio in the S&P 500. Now, when we look at that forward price to earnings ratio average, it's around 17.5. That's the average over the years. So basically, with the market down where it is right now, the broad market is a little bit below its historic averages. Now, before the drop, it had gone slightly above its historic averages. Now it's back down below its historic averages. Expect to see more of that. I don't think we're going to see gangbuster growth in any form next year except in the federal deficit and debt.
Right, and there are some...
And interest rates.
There may be on the healthcare side of things, if we don't see some changes, there probably will be continued profits in there, but it's profits due to lack of competition rather than profits due to new innovation, and I'm uncomfortable with that. We've got a lot of micro monopolies developing in the medical world, and that there's no possible competition in certain areas. Again, that comes back to intellectual property. We need some clear look at our antitrust rules. We need to get those out and dust them off and maybe update them to today's statuses. And we're about out of time for this week. I've enjoyed it. So have you had a good time?
Yeah, it's always nice to get out here and have a conversation with you, although I would have really liked somebody to call in, a good Republican to call in and defend the deficits. We've been asking for this for months.
It's not going to happen, and that's the thing, is that you're a good Republican, and you're the one attacking the problem, and you're not going to have the old conservative fiscal conservatives defend this. They're just going to say, yeah, this tax cut felt good. And you said the same thing. So it's not a good long-term decision for the country, but it sure feels good.
I guess it bothers me that we were in an ideological purity war under the Obama administration, and now we've dumped it. The Republican Party has dumped it and said it's okay to have massive deficits and run us broke.
Yeah, and we're about out of time. If you would like to contact us off the air, we've got voicemail waiting locally.
254-947-1111.
Yes, toll-free 1-800-914-7526. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can go to email us at jeff@tpwc.com. or jake@tpwc.com. We do read those and we use them for the radio. Until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.